Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome artist Leon Lockridge, joining us by phone, and poet John Macker here in the cafe. Their exhibit, Las Montañas de Santa Fe, The Mountains of the Holy Faith, is opening this Friday from 5 to 7 at the Gerald Peters Gallery here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Leon, let's talk about your prints first. They're a wonderful technique of making woodblock prints with multiple color blocks, I guess somewhat in the tradition of Gustav Bauman, is that correct?
Yeah, in that there are multiple colors. Gustav Bauman used a multi-block, so a block for each color. I like using the reduction woodblock process, so which is where you use one block, traditionally use one block, and then you print a color with that block, cut into that block after you've printed, and print another color, then cut away and print another color, and you keep cutting away on the block between each printing, eventually destroying the block. As opposed to using just one block, I'll use three and be cutting away on each one. And it's kind of fun because I like to think of it as painting with the wood blocks, because I'm always reacting to what I have as opposed to setting the design and the whole composition out from the beginning and then printing.
That's amazing that you're actually destroying the blocks as you use them. That makes them truly limited edition, because the original printing block is gone by the end.
Right. And some people have asked, why do I have such odd edition numbers? And the editions are low. I'll have an edition of 19 or 23 or 26. And that's because at the end of the printing, I'll go through and count how many good prints I have. And that determines the edition size. There's no going back and reprinting more because you've destroyed the blocks.
What is the nature of the colors that you use?
Pretty much I mix all my own inks. I started with the base colors, commercially produced colors, and then I'll have a transparent base, but then I mix the colors I want from there. And again, it's you're always reacting to what you've just printed, to what you have, and where you want to go. And that's why, again, I always think of it as painting with wood blocks.
So the feeling of place in these prints is very strong. We have a lot of places that are very familiar to those of us who live in northern New Mexico. You grew up here?
Right. I grew up in Pewaukee. So in between Santa Fe and Española, and kind of the rule when we were growing up was if we want lunch, be there, otherwise be back for dinner. And so we tended to just roam and run through all the country and explore and do things. And then I would go on drives with my mom and we would just start driving and exploring. So it's, I love the country, I love the history, I love the culture. So there's a nice background to it all.
The feeling of place, both in the compositions and in the color, is very strong. That wonderful sense of color that I think surprises so many people when they move to New Mexico is something that you capture very strongly in your work.
It is. I mean, I love the southwestern colors, in the southwest you tend to get very dramatic changes of light and dark with the muted pastel colors, And I love that almost chiaroscuro effect that you get when you're out walking or hiking, especially toward the end of the day or approaching storm, and you get the dramatic lighting. That's always exciting.
And it must be challenging to really be working both with pure color in the method that you use with the wood blocks and also really trying to get that light and dark effect at the same time.
If you think of values, I mean, you're almost getting into the technical side of it all, because I always think of value. If I establish my values, my light and darks, then the color happens from there, and then it's really fun, and that's when you really build the drama with the light and darks, and it's fun to take us out. Normally, I'll go out sketching and gather, and I really won't have any set determined idea of what I want. When I come back to the studio with those piles of sketches, I'll then compile maybe from two sketches and create one image that I really want. And that becomes my roadmap of what I want to do with the woodblocks.
We're sitting here also with poet John Macker. John, how did the two of you start working together? You do poetry, which is just as grounded in place as Leon's work is visually, yours in words.
He had been coming in the gallery for a number of years, and we just got to talking. And it was an organic process, I think. It was a very casual process. We just started talking about our history, what we liked about New Mexico, what struck us about New Mexico, what attracted us to the state, to the landscape, to the landforms. And we talked about how it is represented in art, both literature and visual art. And we just were simpatico in how we viewed the state, viewed the culture, viewed the churches, viewed the mountains, and that there was so much history, so much culture, so much beauty, so much mystery, so much magic, that we thought a collaboration might work between the two of us. And so when I say organic, it's kind of interesting in that he didn't set down a series of images and say, you should write about this image or this peak or this church or anything, and vice versa. I didn't say, well, I'm going to write a poem about this and you can do an image about Starvation Peak. What it was he kind of went off on his own, and we had touchstones. We had like Truchas Peak, Starvation Peak, Penitente Peak, certain churches that Leon was attracted to visually, and then I just went off on my own and decided that it might be interesting to write about what was going on below Las Montanas de Santa Fe, the coyotes on the highway, the fetishes on the mesas, all those kind of gritty New Mexico images that work so well not only on canvas and as a woodcut, but as a poem, too. There's good poets in New Mexico who take advantage of these images.
It's so interesting. This is the second collaboration between an artist and a poet that we've had on this week. Earlier, we spoke to poet Miriam Sagan and photographer Teresa Neptune, who also traveled around New Mexico and are also having an exhibition of their work collaboratively. Would you, John Macker, like to read one of your poems?
Sure. Let me read one of them in there called Coyotl, and it's a C-O-Y-O-T-L. It's kind of the Aztec spelling of Coyotl, which I think is kind of interesting. Coyote, of course, in New Mexico is ubiquitous. It's the trickster. It's the power animal for a lot of people. It's everywhere, and it's certainly around my house. I live near Bernal. And so this is called Coyotl. Coyote blitzes across the mountain highway, and I miss him by this much. But I could still see the wind blowing through his crooked smile as he vaulted the guardrail in the tapioca snow. It's no secret he gave birth to thunder in his trickster youth. No secret he resents the world's loneliness. And he harangues the moon because it's there and always defers to its precocious melancholy. Prefers to watch the pollen-streaked sunrise from the summit of Penitente Peak. Gorges himself on wild datura, and in a dream blames global warming for the creeping fungus stains on the cave walls at Lascaux. As sensate as he is promiscuous, he calls out my dogs like a gunslinger and then yips a litany of excuses until he's long out of sight. And during the drought, he wanders the mountains twice as far for food and squats like a bodhisattva under a virga waiting for rain. And in his more blissful moments, he'll tell you his diurnal wanderings leave footpaths on the chambers of the heart, deep in the heart of New Mexico. And in the spring, he paddles far up the Pecos until ravens peck his shadow off the surface of the still river, and he locates a drawing of himself on a wilderness cave wall where he'll wait with belated breath to be reborn again.
Poetry of John Macker. Leon Lockridge, this exhibition is not only the poetry and the prints hanging on the wall, but it's also some special edition books. Tell us about that.
It's a fun exploration, kind of as John is saying, to explore, kind of put our ideas together of our experiences in the Southwest. A great image of we started comparing ideas and our thoughts about Black Mesa and how it affects you or the visitor. And it's a great combination putting these two ideas together, putting the art, which is exploring value, static imagery, and color, with poetry, which I think, maybe John could correct me, but it's just exploring ideas and multiple verbal images. It seems like poetry, you get more imagery and more insights to different areas, as where with an artwork, you'll take one image and really explore the value and the atmosphere with it. So it's been fun to put it all together into a book and combine them. It's been fun also doing the printing, and as John said, we kind of had an idea of where we wanted to go, and then it was like, let's see how we get there. And that's been the really fun part, is getting there.
And John, also, tell us more about the printing.
Well,
oh, go ahead.
One of the interesting things, not only is Leon a fine artist and a fine woodcut artist, but he's a bookmaker par excellence. I visited his studio in Denver, and he has two old letter presses in his studio that he used to print this book, as well as other, more modern devices. And he's just a great bookmaker in a kind of a lost art form, or an art form that is more precious and precocious than it needs to be. I wish it was more common, but the book is just delightful to look at, as far as not only the printed word, but the woodcuts are represented just beautifully. And it's just a gorgeous work of art to have in your hand. And so not only will this limited book be available along with the prints on the wall, but he also did some limited edition broadsides as well, image and poem. And they're just beautiful. And so he's kind of a master bookmaker as well as an artist.
It's a chance to see that wonderful letterpress printing and very beautiful paper and some handmade paper.
Absolutely.
And things that we're not as don't see as often perhaps in this internet era, which has its own merits. The exhibition is called Las Montañas de Santa Fe, The Mountains of the Holy Faith. It's opening this Friday from 5 to 7 at the Gerald Peters Gallery. Artist Leon Lockridge and poet John Macker, thank you both so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome artist Enrique Figueredo. His exhibition, Nuevas Culturas, is opening this Friday, July 24th, from 5 to 8 at El Zaguán at 545 Canyon Road in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you.
So you are a what's it called? Woodcut printer?
Yeah, it's just called woodcut or woodblock printing, you know.
And so what is the process by which you do your work? Let's start with that.
Well, I just buy a block of wood. You know, you can get them anywhere. And then I just paint them black and carve into them, you know.
And so you actually paint them before you carve into them. That way you can see what you're doing better?
Yeah, I prefer to do that. Some people don't. That's pretty brave, you know. But I think if I paint them black, I can get more detail, you know, and more precise marks, you know.
So these are very, I mean, woodblock printing seems to be such a different process than drawing, which is very free, and some of your work combines both drawing and woodcut. You do quite interesting political art, and I'd love to talk to you about some of the different pieces that you do. One of the pieces which I really thought was terrific was inspired by the night of election night 2008.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, for a lot of people like myself, that was a really big night. You know, the election of Obama. And, you know, I watched closely with a lot of friends and family when he was at the inauguration or the acceptance speech in Grant Park. And just watching the looks on people's faces, to me, was just, you know, epic, and just like a sigh of relief. And when they showed Jesse Jackson crying with the flag, that was, you know, something that I captivated in my brain. And then from there, I went ahead and carved other political leaders like Martin Luther King and Mandela and Malcolm X, because I felt like they were all there present watching with us as well. So that was the inspiration for that piece.
You are originally from Venezuela and are very much immersed in both cultures, Venezuelan and United States. And there's a very interesting picture of Hugo Chavez wearing a wig and an outfit that makes him look kind of like George Washington.
Yeah.
Or some other kind of 18th century political leader.
Yep.
What's that all about?
Well, I just am totally fascinated with the man. I feel like he's extremely interesting, brave, very radical, you know, and, you know, whether you like him or not, you have to just accept him and just find so much inspiration from him, you know. And I feel, my personal opinion of him, he's just a complete egomaniac, and that's why I threw the wig on him, because I feel like he sees himself as a Napoleon on a throne, or, you know, a Washington, or a Simon Bolivar, you know. So that's how I saw him, just, you know, with the drapery and the, you know, the colonial wig, and with that face of his, it's just, you know.
It's a great picture. It also opens up a kind of set of political questions about what do you do when you like somebody's ideas, but you find them to be a gigantic egomaniac, and some of that ego does some harm.
Right. Definitely does, you know. But most of the leaders of the world are, you know, were egomaniacs or are egomaniacs, you know, and I feel like there's, sometimes you have to be, to be able to get your point across, but at the same time, it could be dangerous at the same time, you know. So it's just, I don't know, it's always a give and take, you know, it's always extremes, you know. We can never be, you know, in the medium, you know, level. So
now, some of your work is inspired by, you came from Venezuela, you moved here as a young person, and you lived in Michigan for a while, and there's a picture, a woodblock print that you've made that is inspired by Detroit.
Yeah.
And you actually started it before the economic downturn and the bailout and all of that, but it definitely references the mm-hmm. economic situation that we're in now.
Yeah. Well, I just feel like Detroit is an American ruin already, and it's such a important historical place, you know, because that's where the auto industry started, and it was a huge city. It was a big metropolis. Everybody wanted to, you know, live in Detroit, and I also feel like it reflects a lot of places all over the world where they've been exploited and have become, you know, ghost towns and really poverty-stricken cities and countries. So while I was in Michigan, I went to Detroit, and I was just astonished to see, you know, how what it's like. You know, it's like a ghost town in some places. A lot of violence and crime, but at the same time, it's the downtown area is beautiful, great architecture, and you know, there's a brand new ballpark and Ford Field, and you know, General Motors, the big Renaissance Center, and it just, again, just more extremes. Like you have like extreme poverty, and then you have these super rich companies and corporations that work out of there, but nobody lives in Detroit. Everyone lives in the suburbs. So, so that's what inspired the beginning of that piece, and I started to carve out, you know, immigrant workers from Mexico that came, and you know, the African Americans, and the people who have been working at factories for years and years, and then you know, were laid off, and then the bailout happened, and that was just like fresh air for me. I was like, oh my God, even more, you know, inspiration for me. So it just turned out to be a really good piece, you know, and very powerful for me.
And referencing of this heyday of Detroit and Motor City and all that, which is so gone now.
Oh, it's gone. Motown, even the music. I mean, you think about all the music that came from Detroit, you know, Motown, Michael Jackson, you know, the late Michael Jackson, you know, sorry about that, you know, but, and Parliament Funkadelic and all those people. It's just, it's such a great city with so much history, you know, and now it's just, the music scene is still alive and well there, but the fact that people are losing their jobs so quickly is what's scary about, you know, Michigan. And it's unfortunate because that's where all the headquarters are for all these automobiles, but there's no jobs there, so it's just really weird for me.
So you came from Venezuela and came from a family that was very clear about maintaining your Latin South American culture. While you were here in the United States, you were in San Francisco, Michigan, New York, and then recently you moved to Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like for you to be here in this once Mexico, New Mexican city?
It's really great. It's the first time I've lived somewhere so open. Like San Francisco is, it's really crowded. New York is. Michigan is not so crowded, but New Mexico just has this feeling of openness, where life comes together just because it's in the middle of the desert, you know, and
you mean like spatial openness or people being open to each other?
Both, you know, the spatial openness is foremost, you know, I just think it's beautiful, you know, and just the scenery is very esoteric here, you know, and the people also, there's like a sense of community too, and that's really important. And like you mentioned, the history here for me is just, I'm always curious, and I'm always being challenged every day that I'm here. And, you know, that wasn't the case in New York and Michigan and San Francisco. I want to know more about what happened here and the current, you know, lives of you know, not only Mexicans or New Mexicans, you know, because I think they're really just Mexicans, you know, and then the Native Americans, too, that culture. I'd like to really explore that, you know. So it's just really nice to be somewhere where I'm challenged and inspired every day.
You're a resident at the Historic Santa Fe Foundation.
Yeah.
And that's a place where artists are selected to come and they can live there for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. It's an incredible space for people to work, for you to be living and working in.
Oh, definitely. I think the Historic Santa Fe Foundation is great. You know, the fact that they, you know, acquired this piece of property on Canyon Road, which has been there for years, you know, it's probably one of the oldest properties on the road, and they just opened it up to artist residents, you know, and it's been the longest continuous artist residency, I think, in the area of Canyon Road area, and it's just a great place to live and great just aesthetically, you know, it's not perfectly groomed, you know, it's just very rough and just natural, you know, and the people there are just really nice and laid back, and it's just, I'm very lucky to be there, and I'm, you know, grateful for it every day.
Some of your current work is combining woodblock prints and painting, which are, as we started to talk about a moment ago, two very different styles of painting. One of them incredibly painstaking and obsessive, and the other, at least in your hands, quite free.
Yeah. this new stuff that I'm working on is it makes me feel free, you know, and I think that was also inspired by moving to Santa Fe, because I've always been doing these woodblocks, which have been very meticulous and obsessive at times, you know, and then now that I'm combining them with paint, I just, you know, it's totally raw painting, spontaneous painting, and it's not technical whatsoever. So when you see these together, you kind of don't know what to think. You know, you don't know whether I'm taking the painting, you know, seriously or I'm not, or if the wood blocks are being taken seriously or they're not, and it's just chaotic, you know. And I guess that's just the way I've been feeling lately. So it's nice to express that on paper.
One of the paintings is of an acacia with the, I don't know what they're called, the devices that stop or open the flow of the water, and the water is red blood. What's the inspiration for that?
Well, a friend of mine who's, I would say, just a historian, not by, you know, he doesn't have, like, his degrees, but he just studies New Mexican history, like, day in and day out, as he's fascinated with it. And he told me this story one night he was over, I think I was barbecuing or something for everybody, and he told me that the acequia madre was used to win wars between the Native Americans and the Spanish, where the Spanish would, you know, take over the river and stop its flow, and then the Native Americans would, you know, have to go away and find other land, and then the Native Americans revolted and, you know, stopped the river from flowing, and then the Spanish got scared and went away, and it was like a back and forth thing, you know. So
the control of water being basically the lifeblood,
right.
And in your painting, literally the blood of the community.
It was just such a, like, he was telling me the story, and the image just came into my head, just manifested itself, because I just found it so interesting that, you know, just that little bit of water was the turning point for a lot of land, you know, and the blood is just blood, because, I mean, we're shedding so much blood, and I mean, we have been since the beginning of time, I guess, you know, just all kinds of religious and land and, you know, battles between countries and stuff is just so much blood, so I don't know. It's just, I had to paint the blood, I guess.
Now, your paintings have a lot, your woodcuts and paintings, your artwork have a lot of, not exclusively, but certainly a lot of them have political themes. How do people respond to political versus, let's say, landscape and scenery, you know, architectural scenery types of art?
Well, you get two different reactions. You get one reaction that is a positive one, where people kind of applaud you for trying to send a message, you know, and then you get the other response, which is a negative one, which people kind of categorize you as being a cliche, like you are using, you know, political art to make a name for yourself, you know, and you don't really have any imagination because you're just doing political art, you know. So, you know, the challenge is with landscape art is to make the landscape speak, you know, and be poetic, and that's very difficult. So, you know, you just get different kind of reactions, positive and negative. But I stick to the political work just because it's so inspiring to me, and just there's so much injustice and a need for peace that I can't focus on anything else at the moment. So,
Enrique Figueredo is an artist whose exhibition Nuevas Culturas is opening this Friday, July 24th from 5 to 8 at El Zaguán at 545 Canyon Road here in Santa Fe. You can find more at historicsantafe.org. Enrique, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome filmmaker Chai Vassarelli. Her film is called Yusundur, I Bring What I Love, and it opens this Friday, July 24th, at The Screen here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello.
Great to have you. Now, Yusundur is a very famous Senegalese singer, percussionist, recording artist. How did you come to make a film about him?
Well, I was interested in making kind of a big, beautiful film about Africa. I think there are a lot of images that are in the media, and you know, while there are some very, very serious issues in Africa, I thought that it was also important to be able to present kind of a dignified and hopeful view of Africa. And I think Yusu really embodies that. But what really made me make the film was after I kind of decided to start looking into the subject, I met Yusu and he shared with me his Egypt album. And his Egypt album basically sings the praises of the Senegalese Sufi saints who are Muslim. And this is not so long after 9/11, and I was kind of struck by this beautiful and peaceful image of Islam that I thought was not what we were seeing in the mainstream media. And I thought that a film that chronicled Yusu's progress with this project and how he released it to the, you know, to Western audiences and in Africa would be able to share this story with a wider audience.
It is an interesting story because the disc, Egypt, was actually better accepted outside of Senegal than inside. Why was that?
Well, what's interesting about the Egypt album was initially Yusu was going to release it in 2001, and then 9/11 happened, and he postponed the release because he didn't want it to be received in support of the acts of violence in 9/11. So he finally released it in 2003 because he thought it could actually help promote a different image of Islam. And what happened was it was released in Senegal, and it just triggered this controversy that was really, at the end of the day, a tragic misunderstanding, where immediately, you know, there were radio talk shows and people were calling in raising objections, and there was this rumor that Youssou N'Dour, who's famous for being a pop star, he owns a nightclub in Senegal, had brought, you know, like naked women to the holy sites of Senegal, etc., which were all lies. But the controversy broke out so fast that really people never had the opportunity to actually listen to the album and understand what he was trying to do. And overnight, I mean, 20,000 cassettes were returned by local merchants. They were just scared to have it. You know, it was taken off the television station in terms of his, you know, his paid advertising. They just removed it. They wouldn't play it. And what happened was like a radio silence. It was kind of, it became a taboo subject, and this situation persisted for about a year. Meanwhile, you know, Yusu believed in the project, and he thought that he had confidence that his audience, once they actually had a chance to listen to it, would understand. So he began to release it in the West, and he toured Western Europe and America. And it was, I mean, it was embraced. And, I mean, for me, I still get kind of emotional when I look at the scenes in the film of, like, these predominantly non-Muslim audiences in, let's say, Munich or, you know, New York, dancing to Yusu's Allah Allah. And it just, it was so moving at the time. But there was this kind of tragic misunderstanding at home. And it really triggered this kind of very difficult period in Yusu's life where I think he certainly did doubt what he was doing.
It does highlight, and we see this very strongly in the film, the extremely strong religious devotion on the part of Muslims in Senegal, who, although it was a misunderstanding, felt so strongly about their religion that they didn't want anything to desecrate it. Is there a conflict between popular music and Sufi Muslim beliefs?
Well, I would actually... I would say that I think that what happened in Senegal is something that we, no matter really where you are right now, you can probably identify and understand it, and that religion in general has been politicized, and it's become kind of like a bad word, and there's a lot of fear and conflict and like conflicted emotions around it. And I think that just even suggestion that there was, you know, something controversial or blasphemous that desecrated, you know, the Sufi guides of Senegal was enough to trigger this fear. And again, it was, in all honesty, not an educated fear. It was ignorant. And, you know, what can you do against ignorance except for, kind of try to continue educating the public? So, you know, I can't really speak to whether there's like a conflict between Sufism and pop culture in Senegal. And I don't believe there is. I think that Yusu, as you see in the film chronicles how Yusu comes through it and how eventually his Senegalese audience does listen to the album and understand it for what it is, and they actually celebrate it. And, you know, for me, that was a really powerful story in terms of, you know, how one man could stand up for what he believes in and essentially change, you know, move his community and society one step forward in terms of tolerance. And, you know, I think that what's going on, you know, here in America, you know, we're dealing with similar issues, you know, where I've been experiencing it even in releasing the film where, like, you know, having a film that's about African Muslims, no matter how beautiful or compelling it may be, it's still not the favorite, you know, people's favorite subject. And there are just a lot of emotions around these topics.
Of course, it also didn't hurt that he won the Grammy Award in terms of opening people to his music.
Well, the Grammy, that's what's so interesting, is that the Grammy Award, well, Yusu won essentially the Grammy Award for World Music for the Egypt album, and when this happened, it forced kind of a recontextualization in Senegal about the album. Because you've got to think about it more like an Olympic gold. It was like the first time this type of major international honor was won by a Senegalese national. And it was such a big deal. And, you know, really it forced the press and the public to ask, you know, what's the big deal? What is it about this album? And it really triggered the first time where they actually listened to it. And upon listening to it, they accepted it. And I think it also coincided with Youssou deciding to record a duet with this religious singer in Senegal called Mustapha Mbaye, which essentially praises the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And it's that stamp of approval also helped. But, it, I mean, it was so interesting, like, to see this Western award, like, trigger this recontextualization, reckoning, and try this effort to understand on the part of the Senegalese public of Youssou's music.
We're talking to filmmaker Chai Vassarelli. The film is called Youssou N'Dour, I Bring What I Love. Youssou N'Dour comes from a family of mixed caste. His mother was from the Griot caste. His father was not. What is the role of his mother's caste in society?
Well, a Griot singer is essentially a praise singer. They serve as an oral historian for a community. They really are the storytellers. I liken it sometimes to the bard in Shakespearean drama, or the chorus in Greek tragedy, where their duty is to speak for the people, you know, to be sort of a consciousness for the community. And, you know, Youssou comes from a long line of griots on his mother's side. And I think that you can see this influence in his music, in that, you know, here is an individual who has consistently, since the very beginning, stood up and sang about the issues that matter most and pertain most to, you know, the lives of Senegalese. And I think that in Egypt you see, you know, is a very good example as well, is where he was deciding to sing about Islam in a time when Islam was, you know, was terribly misunderstood, and when it was very important to just add another voice to this debate, you know, to just kind of bring a diversity and, like, recognize the diversity of voices within this rich religion.
Had he made devotional albums before, discs before this one, Egypt?
Well, this is the thing, is that Senegalese Islam is part of the fabric of life in Senegal. I mean, every cab driver you see with, you know, Alhamdulillah, praise be to God, written on his taxi, you know, it's just part of the fabric of everyday life. So Youssou has always sang about these Sufi saints in his popular music. And moreover, kind of the particular Sufi brotherhood that Youssou's part of was founded by this one Sheikh Amadou Bamba. And what I find most interesting about him is he's a contemporary figure. He died in 1927, and essentially he gained recognition because he refused to give up his faith when faced with French colonial pressure. And instead of resorting to violence, he accepted exile, and he went into exile and basically became this national figure. So, the confluence of, like, social movement, of political, like, a democratization and a post-colonial situation in Senegal with their religion is present every day. And so Youssou has these songs about Sheikh Amadou Bamba, which really celebrate their national hero as well. I think Egypt also presents a very big stylistic change. Youssou essentially decided to sing with an Egyptian string orchestra. It was the first time he ever performed without his band, the Super Etoile de Dakar, which is a fabulous band. And he released the album during the holy month of Ramadan, which is certainly against the grain. I mean, conventionally, people turn away from worldly activities during Ramadan. So I think he was definitely pushing the envelope. So it was the form that this music took as opposed to the subject matter.
It's interesting to see this film because a couple of years ago we had an exhibition here in Santa Fe at the Museum of International Folk Art called A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal, and it was all about Sheikh Amadou Bamba. So that image is familiar to visitors to that exhibition when you see the Youssou N'Dour movie.
It's a great exhibit.
Yeah.
I saw it in New York. It's a fabulous exhibit. It was like the first time that sort of scholarly work was done on the subject.
Yeah, it was fascinating. It also really brings up issues of colonialism and resistance, which is not the main subject of your film, but it also touches on that.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're speaking about very specific parts of, like, you know, the specificity of Youssou's life in Senegal. You know, but for me, like, I think that what's been very interesting in releasing the film and bringing it to audiences around the world, because it is being released in theaters, you know, everywhere from Japan to, I don't know, Abu Dhabi, and, you know, or to Santa Fe. And, you know, there are very universal themes of, like, faith and family and love that I do believe kind of appeals to a wide audience. And what's, you know, what was kind of the most challenging part of the film, and I hope maybe one of the most successful parts of the film, is, in a way, presenting Youssou that opens up his life to, you know, any audience that you can actually identify with his story and get, you know, be inspired by the fact that here is a man who comes from really, really humble origins. You know, he really started with nothing, you know, from a, you know, pretty poor country in Africa, who decides to stand up for what he believes in and changes his community, if not the world. And, you know, it sounds very idealistic, but that's, I mean, that's really who Youssou N'Dour is.
And the music is fabulous, and we're going to play a little bit at the end here. And, in fact, we're going to give a ticket giveaway in just a few minutes. The film was the winner of the Audience Award at the São Paulo, Brazil International Film Festival. And I'm wondering, have you been to a lot of the places where the film has shown and have been shown and been able to talk about it with audience members?
Absolutely. You know, I've really made up. I personally, like, I'm not Muslim, and I do believe, but I do believe very much in the politics of the film. I think that it's rare that you see a film that goes below the surface and addressing an African or a Muslim subject. And because of the politics, I've remained very committed, and so is Youssou, to promoting the film. So at every opportunity I have to, you know, to present the film in person to audiences, I try to take. And it's, you know, it's been pretty cool. Like, we premiered at the Telluride Film Festival, as well as the Toronto International Film Festival, which are these kind of very well-respected film festivals. But our third, the third place we played was actually in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, which was the first time we've showed it to a Muslim audience. And when the film received the special jury prize, that was kind of a very big deal, because it was their way of lending their support to the film, which opened up a whole, like, the Middle East as a market. Which is interesting. So it's all about the dialogue on both sides. At the same time, you know, I've traveled, I don't know, throughout Europe. We showed it in Africa. That's kind of a big goal that we have, to bring it to audiences in Africa, even though there's not real distribution per se in theaters in Africa. But, you know, people respond really from very, very different backgrounds. And, you know, I've gotten responses where people would come up to me being like, these people aren't Muslims. And I'm like, no, but they really are. But you have to respect where that person's coming from. At the same time, there are people who, like, have never heard of him, never heard of Youssou N'Dour. And it's like their own discovery process. Like, there's something really moving, I think, in this idea that you can recognize your tradition. You know, and that's important.
Has the film been shown in Senegal?
It was the first place it was shown. Before it was actually finished, I wanted to show it to everyone who participated and worked on the film, just to get a sense of, you know, I just wanted to make sure. So many people were very generous with their time and opening up their lives. You know, this film took about 2.5 years to film. And I just wanted to show it to them before there was no going back. So it was very well received, and we're bringing it back to Senegal in December as part of FESMON, which is kind of this international festival of African art that's sponsored by the United Nations.
Chai Vassarelli made the film Youssou N'Dour, I Bring What I Love. It opens this Friday, July 24th, at The Screen, which is at the College of Santa Fe, right here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And here's a little music of Youssou N'Dour as we go out. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's wonderful .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Thanks to Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features 8 different versions of Johnny Mercer's classic Midnight Sun. We're going to hear some more music by Youssou N'Dour and have a ticket giveaway. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station.